sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For Hour is an educational service in the public interest, I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, economics, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on eminent domain, the Kello case, when we come back. You know, over the past century, we Americans who were once independent, capable, and able to manage our own financial, medical, and legal affairs have now been reduced to dependence, incompetence, incapacity. We have now been made wards of powerful commercial, financial, medical, and legal corporations, cartels, and bureaucratic institutions of our modern industrial society. And we've been taught to rely upon these paid professionals. Professionals like bankers to manage our financial affairs, or doctors to manage and treat our health problems, and lawyers to direct our business and legal affairs instead of relying upon our own good common sense. Now, that's why I contend that it's time that we Americans who were once able to catch our own fish learn once again how to fish instead of being fed by these paid professionals. Regaining our power of attorney is the single most important step in regaining our capacity, rights, liberties, and duties. Now, if you'd like to learn more about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you write for my free general law CD package? It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967, to order yours. Or if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about the Kello case. I mentioned to you that I probably received 10 or 15 emails or articles and essays, etc., on the Kello case, blaming the Supreme Court for a bad decision. And I contend that the Supreme Court's taking a bad rap. I was kind of surprised at the numbers. 5-4 is the way the case came down. It should have been 9-0. You know, at least in my view, it was 9-0. And I've been explaining to you what the legal ramifications are concerning this eminent domain. The last item that I want to bring up on this eminent domain is called the literature. We always go to the literature. How do I know that what I'm telling you is true, accurate, and correct? Where would I get the idea? Where do my ideas come from that conflict with the ideas of the authors and the publications that I've cited to you that are in opposition to the Supreme Court? And after all, that's what constitutional controversy is all about. People have different views as to the construction of the constitutionality of various aspects of the law as it relates to the Constitution. Well, there are four primary sources that we go to, and I'll tell you a little story over here. One time I did a declaratory relief, or a declaratory action. I was looking for declaratory relief in federal court. And Judge Clark, who was at that time, he's dead now, but at that time he was our chief judge here in Springfield. And he called me into chambers during the proceedings. And he asked me this question. He said, "Gordon, did you do your legal research?" And I said, "Well, yes, Judge, I think I did." And he proceeded to read me the Riot Act. I mean, he just chewed me a new rectal region. And he said, "You know, you're wasting my time, you're wasting the time of the court, you're wasting the time of the Attorney General of Missouri. I mean, just, you know, if you'd have done your homework over here, Gordon, you wouldn't be here today." And he was kind of a kindly old fellow. He took a liking to me, I think, and he sat me down and he said, "Now, let me explain this to you." And he went ahead and he explained it to me, and he said, "Now, I'm going to rule against you in this case, in this instance. And I'm ruling against you because..." And then he went on to tell me, he said, "Now, had you brought this case in here under the First Amendment, if you had claimed that you were discriminated against, had you come in here and claimed that you were a suspect classification of person, we'd have a much different case before us." Well, I left there that day, and I was a little bit bummed out. You're always bummed out when you lose. But I got to thinking about what Clark told me, and I said, I think the old judge was right. If I'd have thought this through a little better, if I'd have gone to the literature and spent some time digging through the books, I probably would have come up with a better cause of action, a better solution to my problem. And I think that's where Mrs. Kello is here. I think that she had a better solution to her problem had she gone to the books. Now, Mrs. Kello probably just hired an attorney. She doesn't know, her left arm from her right. And she hired an attorney, and the attorney went into court. But the attorney didn't do his homework. And I want to tell you that he didn't do his homework because I did his homework for him. And I can tell you right now, just looking at the cases that have already been settled, already been decided, that had he done his homework, he would have used a different tactic to obtaining Mrs. Kello's objective, which is getting paid just compensation for the piece of real estate that the government is about to take away from her. Now, I've contended throughout the series of programs that the real issue here is just compensation, not whether or not this is a public purpose. And I want to show you why from American jurisprudence. Now, there are four sources that we would go to. First of all, we would look at eminent domain in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, which would give us a little Reader's Digest synopsis of what eminent domain is all about, and some winning and some losing cases. Then to expand upon that, they would send us to the legal encyclopedias, of which there are four. It's Corpus Juris, Corpus Juris Secundum, Words and Phrases, and American Jurisprudence. So I'm going to pull out American Jurisprudence, called AmJur in the trade. And I noticed here that there are 10 sections in AmJur that weigh in or deal with this eminent domain action as it relates to the Kello case. 10 sections. So, just to give you some rudimentary numbers, there are some 300 sections on 777 pages of material. Now, I'm going to just take a look here. Let's just take page 70 here. And I'm looking at the cases that are cited, and I can see here on page 70, just looking at the cases cited, there must be at least 30 or 40 cases on this page in the footnotes, but I'm just going to cut that in half. I can see easy 20. And now I'm going to flip over here to another section over here. I'm on page 77, and I'm looking at the footnotes in this page, and there's easy another 40, so let's cut that in half to 20. Let me just flip over another page over here. I'm on page 84, and I'm looking at the footnotes on page 84, which occupies approximately 3/4 of the page, and there's easy 40 more citations here, cases on eminent domain, so let's cut that in half. That's 20. I think it's safe to say that there are at least 20 cases cited on every page of 777 pages. Now, let me just multiply that out. 20 times 777 is 15,540 cases on eminent domain that are cited in this one encyclopedia called American Jurisprudence. Now, nobody's going to read all 15,540, so the writers of the encyclopedia break it down into sections. Let me give you a couple of illustrations on what we're talking about when we're talking about sections. So let me flip over here to section 273 and section 274. And here's the subheads. It says, changes in circumstances or in condition or value of property, that's section 273, would we be interested in the condition or the value of the property of Mrs. Kello? Number 274, change in purchasing power of money. Would the inflationary value of Mrs. Kello's property over the years of the litigation and over the future years of litigation come into play on her property? I think that it would. So there's two sections that we need to look at. Now, let me take the other book here. I'm going to flip over here to the next. It's in two volumes. 777 pages wouldn't fit into one volume. So they get two volumes here, which is just about, for the sake of our argument here, a volume of 777 pages, which would be a big, thick book on eminent domain. Now, that's a lot of material. And I would submit that had this lawyer gone to American jurisprudence and spent some hours of time, I know it would take some actual work, but some hours of time, and look through the index and cite all of these subsections that would or could possibly be relevant, and then inform himself of that, he never would have brought that case. He never would have brought that case in the form that he brought it in. And probably the case didn't need to go to trial, because as I said earlier, the issue isn't can the city of New London take the property for the purposes that they want. The issue is, do they have to pay this woman what the just value or the just compensation is, and what is that just compensation? So let's take a look at sections 35, 36, and 37. Section 35 deals with partly private and partly public purpose. 36, private construction of, payment for, or contribution to costs of improvement. And 37, as affected by public or private character of the condemner. Now remember, they went in there and they said, you can't take this property. And the reason you can't take this property is because it's not for a public purpose. And it's not for a public purpose because you're going to turn it over to a private party. Now here's three sections that deal with government taking property and then turning it over to a private party like Union Pacific Railroad or Walmart or Costco, or a developer, or we're going to build a Cabrini Green, or whatever it is, or urban renewal, or whatever we're going to do. And I mean, all the cases that deal with urban renewal, and Chavez Ravine, and et cetera, they're all listed here in this 777 pages. Now, I didn't read 777 pages to put this series of programs on. I probably read 20 pages. But I went to the index first, and I went through these 300 sections, I'll tell you how many sections there are. I'm in the second book here, so let me just tell you how many sections there are here. Eminent domain, 457. Takes us up to equity. We don't want equity. Let me flip back here a little bit more. Equitable conversion. We don't want equitable conversion. Here we go. We're on page 480 here. Employment agencies. Let me back up a little more. Here's the last one. Section 507. I said there was 300. There's 507. So there's 507 sections or subject matters to be discussed under eminent domain in American jurisprudence. Now, this is what we call doing the legal research. And legal research is the hub of determining what your cause of action is. I mean, you got to get down here to the nitty gritty. When you come into court, you know, and you spend 3 or 4 years and several thousand bucks. Now, I would imagine that this lady taking this case all the way to the Supreme Court spent in the neighborhood of $250,000. So I hope this lady's property is worth a bunch of money, because she spent a bunch of money to get this case before the Supreme Court, which typically is about $250,000 the average guy's going to be paying to get that case decided. So by the time you spend $250,000 to find out that you're barking up the wrong tree, it's kind of an expensive lesson unless you got lots of money. All right, so let's take a look at Section 202, Light, Air, and View. Remember I mentioned to you, I said the most valuable thing that I think this lady's got that she wants to get paid for is the view. And that comes in Section 202. So let me just flip forward here. Eminent domain. Here's Section 194. Here's Section 202. Interference with access, light, air, and view. And I would contend that the city of New London is going to interfere with Mrs. Kello's view of the bay when they take her house. Now, well, they've got Mrs. Kello's mind and got Mrs. Kello's brain power and her view on the nails, the boards, the glass, the rock, the mineral, and the earth. The real value that Mrs. Kello has in this split estate property is the view. Now, what have the courts said about this thing of the view in other cases? So if we look at Section 202 and Section 200, let me start with Section 200 and then Section 202. It says interference with access, that is light, air, and view as a taking. And I thought to myself, well, gosh, interference with access. I mean, if you take my property away from me, I guess I couldn't access it anymore. And you're going to take away my light, my air, and my view, and as a taking. How does that apply to a taking? The government wants to take it. Do they have to pay for the view? Well, they tell us, first of all, as a general thing, where the easements of access, light, air, and view are recognized in an abutting owner, the devotion of the adjacent street or highway to inconsistent uses destructive of such easements is a taking of property within a constitutional provision requiring compensation thereof. And there's a footnote number called 7. So I look at number 7 down here, and it refers me to a case called Crawford versus Des Moines, 255 Iowa 861. And it says, rights of access, air, light, and view held compensable by second condemnation proceeding where the first proceeding condemned the property as depreciated by the damage to or loss of such rights due to the construction of a state highway to which the condemner, the city, had consented. All right, so there's my first clue. Yes, Mrs. Kello does have an action for the taking of that view. The literature tells us that when you take the view away from somebody, you're taking something that is compensable. Now, remember, I mentioned this earlier, so let's analyze this again. Why does the city of New London want Mrs. Kello's property? Why don't they go and take Mr. Johnson's property or Mrs. Burkhart's property across town? Why doesn't the city of New London go out here and buy 16 acres of land over in the industrial park out by the airport to build this highway or to build this hotel and these shops and etc.? It's because the city of New London knows full well that if they went out and built these commercial structures out at the airport or in any other place in New London, Connecticut, nobody would go there. Boys and girls, you have to build hotels in places where people want to go. Now, it happens that Mrs. Kello has the view of the bay. How she got the view of the bay, I don't know, but she's got it. And she was there first, and she owns it, and it's her property right. Now, irrespective of what we've discussed earlier, that split estate, the fact that she's paying property taxes and House Joint Resolution 192 and zoning and planning and all the rest of it, she doesn't have an absolute right. She doesn't have a property right here as an absolute fee simple, but she does have some property rights, and they're called incorporeal property rights. Intangibles, not nails. Not glass, not boards, not earth, rock, or mineral, but an intangible called the view, which is adjacent to, which can't be separated from the property itself. That physical piece of property, where it's located, overlooking that bay over there, is what makes that piece of real estate, that earth, that mineral, that rock, so valuable. It's the view of the bay. That's because when people go to New London, they will stay in a Holiday Inn that is located over the bay where they've got this beautiful view. Let me give you an illustration. Let's suppose you're in San Francisco, California. And I remember my stepfather, years ago, back in the 1950s, he had an apartment on the fifth floor. I mean, this is a five-floor walk-up. You got to walk up five flights of stairs to get up to his apartment. When you look out his window in his apartment, it looks out across an alley directly into the brick wall of another building. Now, what do you think the rent on that apartment is? Five-floor walk-up with a view of a brick wall on the other side of the alley. Now, my stepfather lived there because that's the cheapest rent you could get. I mean, this is one of the cheapest apartments that you could find. The rents go up as you go down. See, on the first floor, the rents are higher than on the fifth floor because you don't have to walk up five flights. Let me give you another illustration. I happened to be out along Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, and I went into my mother's apartment, and she had good taste. And as I recall, it was her apartment overlooked Golden Gate Park. And Golden Gate Park is just a block wide, but it's about, I don't know, several miles long. And it's kind of like Central Park in New York. It's right in the middle of the city. And her apartment, when you open the window or the blinds or the drapes, overlooked the street out in front, of course, but then it looked right out over the park. And she paid quite a bit more money, and I know she made view of the fact they'd been divorced by this time, but I just want to point out she made a point that Howard was living in this crummy five-floor walk-up with no view, and here's her lovely apartment overlooking Golden Gate Park. Now, let's ask you what the real estate values are. Real estate values. Do you think that the value of the apartment, the building overlooking the brick wall or the building that's overlooking Golden Gate Park is going to have the greatest appeal to people coming to San Francisco and who would be staying in a hotel? So I think that we could all agree that if the Holiday Inn were going to buy one of these two buildings, my mother's building or my stepfather's building, that they would take my mother's building overlooking Golden Gate Park because it's got a more pleasant view. And it's more likely that out-of-state or out-of-town visitors would stay in a hotel that when the guests opened the window, they could look out upon Golden Gate Park as opposed to opening their window and looking out upon a brick wall. And ladies and gentlemen, that's exactly why the city of New London wants Mrs. Kello's real estate, because it looks out over the bay. That's why they want it. Now, is it compensable? Absolutely. Now, I don't know what the residential value of her house is. And I said the other day that we'll just pick a number, $200,000. That's about the median average price of a house in the United States today. And there's 16 houses they want to take to build this hotel and shopping center, etc. And it's worth about $3 million. And they want to pay Mrs. Kello and these other 15 people the residential value because at this time, it's residential. It's not commercial. And in looking at the literature tells us that, yes, they can do that. You cannot get paid for the future speculative value of this property. Now, I would sue for that future speculative value anyway because of the unique character. In other words, this is one of those kind of cases where you actually might set new case law precedent. And I'll tell you why I think the new speculative value is relevant in this case. You see, as residential property, this property produces about $50,000 a year in taxes. Let's just figure, for the sake of our discussion, that Mrs. Kello is paying $2,500 a year in taxes times the 16 other people who are living in or around her, and that's about $40,000. So the city of New London's getting $40,000 a year. We'll round it off to 50. Now, along comes the Holiday Inn, and they say, look, we'd like you to condemn this property over here. Give it to us, and we'll build a big hotel over here and attract people from all over the world, and they'll come to New London. And we will pay 10 times more taxes, and we will employ 100 people in our hotel. Now, how many people are being employed by Mrs. Kello and her neighbors? Zero. And how much tax are they paying? $50,000 a year. Wouldn't it be in the public interest, mayor and city council, for the Holiday Inn to build a hotel here where Mrs. Kello now lives by condemning her property and the property of her neighbors, and we will pay $500,000 a year in taxes and employ 100 people who in turn will be paying taxes. And so the city says, well, that's a heck of a good idea. And it's a public purpose. It brings employment. It brings a higher tax base. And if this hotel is paying $500,000 a year in taxes, then Mrs. Kello and her neighbors and all of the other neighbors in New London will have to pay less tax because we'll have more out-of-town people paying these taxes, and that will be a public purpose. And besides that, the courts have said that's a public purpose in times past, which is why I was surprised that they raised the issue to the Supreme Court, and why I was even more surprised that the court divided 5-4 on this Kello case when in times past they have voted unanimously that, yes, you can take property in West Oakland. Yes, you can take property and you can redevelop it. That's what I was surprised about, but, you know, I suppose that's the way the cookie crumbles. But notice this, that Section 200, interference with light, air, is a taking. Now, in Section 202, there's a statement made concerning this thing of the view. And I said, I think Mrs. Kello's view here is what everybody's after. It's not the rock, mineral, or earth. They could go out to the airport industrial complex and buy rock, mineral, and earth. They can go all over New London, Connecticut and buy rock, mineral, and earth. There's no shortage of acreage to buy for a whole lot less money than Mrs. Kello's got. It's not the rock, mineral, and earth that they want. It's the view that they want, Mrs. Kello. It's the view. Or put another way, let's suppose Mrs. Kello's property was located right next door to the Bethlehem Steel Factory, or across the street from it. And across the street is all of this noxious noise at the steel factory. And all these 16 neighbors around Mrs. Kello are living across the street and around the steel factory over here, which emits clouds of noxious gases and fumes. Now, do you think that the Holiday Inn in the city of New London would be knocking on Mrs. Kello's door, trying to take her rock, mineral, and earth, her nails, glass, and boards, to give it to the Holiday Inn to build a hotel? Do you think the Holiday Inn would be knocking on the city of New London's door, saying, would you please condemn this property across from the steel mill so that we can build a hotel? I tell you, boys and girls, the one thing that Mrs. Kello has here, the one thing that everybody wants, the city wants, the hotel wants, is the view of the bay. It has nothing to do with nails, glass, and boards, rock, mineral, and earth. It has to do with that view. Now listen to this. Interference with access, light, air, and view. Many cases hold that interference with an abutting owner's easement of access by a bridge or other structure in the street or highway is a damage or injury to property for which he may recover compensation under constitutional provision that private property shall not be taken or damaged or taken damaged or destroyed or taken injured or destroyed for public use without compensation. The view has a value. Now, if the city came along in front of Mrs. Kello and they built a great big wall, and this actually happened down in Florida, there was a guy that had a view of a pond, a small lake, and there were a bunch of neighbors around him, and they could also look across his property and view this lake. And this guy went over to the neighbors and he said, now, I want you to pay me $50 a month for the view of this lake over here. And of course, the neighbors looked at him and said, you got to be nuts. And they wouldn't pay him the 50 bucks a month or whatever it was he was demanding. And I don't know, there's 6 or 8 people that live around him. You got to remember that Florida is about as flat as a pancake. And these people are looking across his property. So he comes out to the edge of his property and he builds a 10-foot-high wall. 10-foot-high wall. And now all these neighbors cannot see the pond. All they can see when they look out there, when they open their blinds, like my mother, they just open the blinds and all they look across the street and what they see is a great big blank wall. And they get real mad and they sued over that. I don't remember what the court's name was. It could have been the Supreme Court of Florida, whatever. They said, well, yeah, he's got a constitutional right to build that wall there. It's a fence. He's got a right to build a fence. He got the permit to build the fence. He has a right to build a fence. You don't have any constitutional right to look out across his property at this pond over here. Now, if the city had done that to Mrs. Keller, let's suppose that they just went out there and said, "Well, we own the land out here that's on the view of the bay, and we're just going to build a great big high fence across here, Mrs. Keller, so you can't see the bay." She would have a takings action against the city. You don't have an action against a private party, but you got an action against the city. That's a taking. It's a taking of her view. Well, now, boys and girls, if you condemn my rock, mineral, and earth, my nails, glass, and boards, and you take my property away from me, aren't you taking my view away? Now, Mrs. Keller's going to be paid money, and she has to go out and buy another house. Do you think she can go around New London, Connecticut, with the amount of money that they're going to offer her? And here's where Mrs. Keller would shine. She should start driving around the city of New London and knocking on doors and saying, "Well, my property over here on the bay is being taken away from me. And I like this bay, and I want to look at this bay, so I want to buy your house that overlooks the bay. What's the price?" And I think you're going to find that view has some value. That view has some value. Furthermore, in Section 200 and Section 202 of AMJUR, they tell us plainly here, this is footnoted number 18, so I go down here to number 18, and in this section here, there must be 20 cases cited, like Chicago versus Taylor, and Rose versus State, and BACICH versus Board of Control, and Pueblo versus Strait, and Paws versus Atlanta. I mean, there's 20 cases here that deal with view. Now, I don't understand why Mrs. Kello's attorney wasn't out here looking at Section 202 in AMJUR and Section 200 in AMJUR, and concentrating on, well, gee, just how much is this piece of property worth? Now, we're going to take a break here, and when we come back, I'm going to talk about this thing of just compensation as it relates to the commercial value of this piece of property. So don't go away. I'll be right back. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. That means we're on 7 days a week. That's every day, 1 hour a day, 365 days a year, year in and year out, with news and commentary on these kinds of subjects. You know, The Law Hour reports on things like law and science and education, economics, politics, religion, news, current events. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. So we're not hiding anywhere. So just go to the website and scroll down, take a look. And remember, the law school teaches family law. That's divorce. Tax law. That's income tax. Courtroom strategy and procedure. That's how to defend yourself in court. Business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Yeah, we even talk about the Bible and the Ten Commandments and the laws of Moses and so on. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. All of these schools are available on compact disc with the paperwork that goes with it that you can study at home. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. So if you want a program like this series of programs here, or you listen to one where you're driving down the road and you say, "God, I'd like to have that program," just go to the webpage, scroll down, lock onto it, and you can take it down just like the radio stations do. Then you can download it in 32-bit. I think it's 32-bit they call it, or 16-bit. Stereo quality. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you these timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. So if you'd like to order that free introductory CD package, just call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers. So don't blame Procter & Gamble. The sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, just go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org or call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about the Kello case this week. And I'm kind of analyzing the way I would have handled the case had it been mine. I never would have raised the issue of, is this taking for a public purpose? And that's because after having reviewed the literature, it's my belief that, and it's the belief of some 15,000 courts that have decided 15,000 cases that are reported on 777 pages of material in some 500 subject matters, of which some of it deals with private developers. So let's take a look at these private developers here. And let's see what comes up with this. 35, 36, and 37 called private parties. So let me flip back here to private parties, section 35, 36, and 37. Remember, they raised this issue, and I think that if they had read these three sections here, it would have pretty well told you that, yeah, the state can come in here and give this to private people. Section 35. Hang on here. I'm still turning pages here. Section 32, 34. Here we go. Section 35. Partly private and partly public purpose. Listen to this. Where there is a combined purpose, partly for public and partly for private use or benefit, and the two uses or purposes cannot be separated, eminent domain cannot be exercised. That's section 19. Well, now Mrs. Kello is arguing here that the city is going to take this for public purpose, but they're going to give it to a private developer who ultimately is going to be a beneficiary of this. And so, based upon, let's see, footnote number 19, and there's about 20, 30, 40 cases here, section 19, you can't do it for that. Okay, well, let's read on and see what else is germane. Where a statute authorizes a single taking for uses both public and private, and does not limit the extent of the taking to the necessities of the public use, it is unconstitutional. Then we've got another footnote, number 20, and there's a series of cases, not as many, but probably 10. However, oh my God, here comes the qualifier. However, when a private benefit and public use are blended and the undertaking is capable of furthering a public use, it is in general the judicial practice to disregard the private benefit as a mere incident. Ah, footnote number one. So we go over here to footnote number one, and it tells us that there are two cases, Nichols versus Central Virginia Power Company, and the Fallsburg Power and Manufacturing Company versus Alexander. There's two cases. Footnote number one. Now, they go on to say, if the uses are separable, even though the private use for which eminent domain may not be exercised is not merely incidental, it has been held that condemnation may be sustained. Footnote number two, Kessler versus Indianapolis, and Sheezus versus Detroit. That's two cases. All right, so now we look at this in our analysis, and we say, well, let's see. They're going to take my property overlooking the bay here in New London, and they're going to give it to the Holiday Inn. But it's going to increase the tax revenue and employ an extra 100 or 200 people, whatever the employment is. It's partly a public purpose, and it's partly a private purpose, but we find out that the courts in general, if they can separate these two, or if there is a public purpose that outweighs the private purpose then becomes incidental. Do we want to take $250,000 and expend it in a gamble that maybe, in this case, the court's going to reverse out its general consensus or its general opinion? Well, in my study of constitutional law, boys and girls, here's the way the cases break down. In a case like Rosa Parks, where we're making a challenge to the constitutionality of a practice, like Rosa Parks did, blacks riding the back of the bus, the chances of taking on a statute and having it declared unconstitutional, per se, is about 10%.
having a practice declared unconstitutional as it applies to me in this case, such as Yoder versus Wisconsin, is about 90%. So it's a choice that you make. I mean, did you want to challenge the constitutionality of this law per se, or did you want to challenge the constitutionality of this law as it applies to me in this case? I think, you know, just based upon the statistical analysis, that the logical conclusion would be, let's just take on the 90% opportunity for victory and challenge the city of New London over the taking of my property pursuant to the compensation that you're offering me. Now, I'm sure that Mrs. Kello would have sold that property. I mean, if you walked up to Mrs. Kello and said, Mrs. Kello, your property is worth $200,000, and we want to offer you $200,000, please sell it to us so we can build a hotel. She might have said, no, I don't think I'll do that. All right, well, we'll give you $400,000, Mrs. Kello. She might have thought, well, that's a pretty good offer, $400,000. No, I don't think I'll sell it for $400,000. About $800,000, Mrs. Kello. How about $1,000,002? Or $1,000,006? Hey, how about $1 billion? Mrs. Kello, would you sell this property for $1 billion? That's $1,000,000,000. At some point in time, boys and girls, I'll assure you, at some point in time, Mrs. Kello is going to say, you know, that view isn't worth as much as $1 billion. I think I'll sell that thing for $1 billion and I'll go buy Orlando Beach or something. You know, I'll just go down to Florida and go buy a whole strip of beach. I'll go buy an island in the South Pacific. The reason that the hotel is coming out here and the reason they're using eminent domain is to screw this woman out of her view. There's a value here that they don't want to pay for. That's the key. And, you know, I'm a businessman, and when I go out to buy a piece of property, I want to buy it as cheap as I can. I mean, I never have in my business career walked up and offered somebody twice what I thought this property was worth. I've yet to do that. I always offer them half as much as I think it's worth. And then we go up from there. And he demands twice as much as he thinks it's worth and goes down from there. Now, that's the way bargaining develops. That's what negotiations are all about. I offer half as much, you demand twice as much, and somewhere in between we get to the real value, which is, well, here's what it's really worth. Now, the hotel should pay Mrs. Kello for the commercial value of the property, and I'll tell you why I think that commerce or commercial comes into play here. Although the literature tells us that when they condemn a property, they only pay you what the property is worth at the time the property is condemned. But I'll tell you why I think that there's an exception here. I think we could make new case law here over compensation, not over public purpose, but over just compensation. Here's why. The Holiday Inn comes along and says, look, we could build a hotel. We've got $100 million sitting over here in our bank account, and we can go out here and buy a piece of ground and build a hotel anywhere in New London, Connecticut. But we know from experience that location, location, location is very important. So if we build two hotels, one out at the industrial park overlooking the steel mill and another one overlooking the bay, we know that more hotel customers are going to want to stay at the bay location than at the industrial park location. That's why location is so important in real estate. So when you're looking at where banks build their towers or where office buildings are built, etc., you'll notice that they didn't build the Twin Towers out at LaGuardia Airport. They built the Twin Towers in Lower Manhattan. You remember that? And they built the Empire State Building in Manhattan. There's a reason why they built the Empire State Building in Manhattan, New York, rather than in Bismarck, North Dakota. It's not because you can't build a 100-story building in Bismarck. It's that you can't get any tenants to rent a 100-story high-rise in Bismarck, North Dakota. But you can get people to rent that space in downtown Manhattan. So that location is very important. So when somebody wants to build a building, they're very cognizant of the location. Now, let me show you something else. Mrs. Kello's property is zoned residential, and residential property isn't worth as much as commercial property. I mentioned that earlier. And the commercial property, you know, depends upon where it is. Now, if you took a piece of commercial property in Manhattan, I mean, just anywhere. I mentioned this the other day on Times Square. It's going to be worth a whole lot more than a piece of residential property over in Queens. In fact, it's going to be worth about 5 times more. And it can be worth 10, 15, or 20 times more. I mean, that stuff sells by the square foot. You know where the Twin Towers were located? They're 16 acres down there in the south end of Manhattan. That 16 acres of ground over there is going to sell by the square foot. I mean, that stuff's worth $1,000 a square foot or something like that. I don't know if it's $1,000 or $100 or whatever. But, you know, it's worth just bare, naked ground there is worth a lot more money than in Bismarck, North Dakota. And that's why the city wants to take Mrs. Kello's land, because it is overlooking that bay. And they're going to take the land, and according to the literature, they're going to pay her the $200,000, which is the comparable real estate value for the rocks, mineral, and earth, and the nails, glass, and boards on a residential house, zoned residential, overlooking that bay. They're going to pay her $200,000. The city is immediately going to rezone that property to commercial and make it worth 5 times as much money, and then they're going to sell that property to the developer, or they've already made this transaction in the back room, the smoke-filled back room, for $1 million. Immediately, Mrs. Kello's property is going to be worth $1 million by simply rezoning it. It may be worth $2 million. It may be worth $20 million just by simply rezoning it. And I contend that Mrs. Kello should be paid a portion of that back room smoke filled deal because of that location. That location. That location. She should be paid a portion of that for just compensation. Because she's got the only piece of property that you can build that hotel on. The Twin Towers could only be built in southern Manhattan. They couldn't be built anywhere else in the United States. It had to be built there. That's why they built them there. That's because if you're going to build an office building that big, you've got to have tenants. You've got to have customers that are willing to pay that kind of rent in that kind of a location. And that hotel knows that. And they know they've got to have a commercial location. They know they've got to have that rezone. They've already got that scoped out. And I told you this earlier. The 16 tenants, the 16 landowners, the residents that live across the street from Mrs. Kello and the other residents whose property is being taken away, their property is instantly going to be worth 5 times more money. Their $200,000 houses are going to be worth $1 million the day that property, that area is rezoned. Now, don't you think that that's unjust enrichment for the 16 neighbors across the street to fall into this windfall profit of, my house is worth $200,000 today, but as soon as the city condemns Mrs. Kello's house, my house is going to be worth $1 million. And then I can sell that to Hardee's or the McDonald's or somebody else who's going to build a hotel. Somebody is going to build commercial across the street from the Holiday Inn. Somebody's going to build a restaurant. There's going to be a Ma and Pa Kettle restaurant or something going across there, a Cracker Barrel or something. It's going to go in. And they're going to have to pay whatever the market will bear. And Mrs. Kello, who lost her view, lost her property, along with the other neighbors, they are taking it in the shorts because they don't get any share whatsoever of that commercial value. That, ladies and gentlemen, is what they should have been arguing to the Supreme Court of the United States. That the city is going to take my property, zoned commercial. And yes, the tradition is, the rule of thumb is, if you're going to take my property, you pay me the residential price. But in this case, she would argue, but in this case, it is not equitable. And that's because if my property had been located across the street, my property would be worth 5 times more money and I wouldn't have to give it up. I could sell it then to Cracker Barrel for $1 million or $2 million to build a restaurant across the street or a KFC franchise, which is going to be across the street from this new Holiday Inn, and they're going to make it, but I'm not. They're not giving up their property, but I have to give up mine. I have to give up my property at a discount. Now, just compensation is an equitable issue. It's an equitable action. And that's where we take a look at the last item called market value. So let's take a look at number 266 and 267. So we come over here and let's flip up. Flip back through the old book here to number 241. Let's flip ahead a little bit more. Maybe wrong book. I'll have to get this other book over here. Let's see what we got here. Number 262 is what I'm looking for. Here's 264. 263, 262, where it tells us generally necessity of advance secured or certain payment. What are we going to get paid, Mrs. Kellum? Well, according to the greatly predominant view, compensation in the absence of a constitutional or statutory requirement otherwise need not be paid or even finally determined in advance of the taking. If reasonable, certain, and adequate provision is made at the time of the appropriation to ascertain and to secure the compensation to be paid to the owner. Where adequate provision is made for the payment of compensation, it is competent for the legislature to authorize the state or city or other condemner to enter or take a fee in the lands prior to the payment of compensation and to manage such property as the owner conformably with the public use, but in no case may the owner be put to risk or unreasonable delay as to his compensation. So the city can come in, take her property, pay her nothing for it, throw her out. Do I have to pay her a quarter? And then at some point in the future, we'll determine what this property is worth. And that's where a jury trial comes in, Mrs. Kellum. I think if it was me, I think I'd go with a jury trial. And I think I would say to the jury, now, ladies and gentlemen of the jury over here, I don't want to sell my property for this price because the price that they're offering me over here is grossly incompatible with the real value. These people want that property because of the view. They want that property because of the location. They're taking my view and my location away from me. Those are incorporeal values, and I want to be paid for those. Now, if I was sitting on your jury, Mrs. Kellum, and you came in and made your argument to me, and you said, now, Mr. Gordon, sitting on my jury, I think that I'm entitled to a piece of the action because, I would listen very attentively, Mrs. Kellum, and I would say, you know, that's exactly right. You see, the neighbors across the street, they're gonna make this windfall profit. As soon as this area is rezoned to commercial, we don't know if it's going to make it worth 5 times more, 10 times more, or 20 times more, but we do know it's going to be worth something more than the residential value. The city knows that. The Holiday Inn knows that. The neighbors across the street know that. Everybody knows that. And Mrs. Kellum and her 16 or 15 neighbors should share in this windfall, whatever it may be. And it may be some kind of a formula that, well, when we develop this property over here, we're going to pay you the residential value today. And then 5 years from now, Mrs. Kellum, we're going to pay you the balance depending upon what the formula is. Now, they did this with the victims of the trade towers. Remember that? They came up with a formula. And they said, well, if you're a yuppie stockbroker sitting on the 100th floor of the trade towers and you got killed up here and you're making $100,000 a year, well, then your death is worth $5 million. But if you're just a busboy working in a restaurant here in the trade towers, well, then you're not worth as much. You're only worth $50,000 or $100,000. They came up with a formula. And I think a formula could be worked out for the Kellum case and with her neighbors. Now, there's one more item over here that I want to bring to your attention. And I think that was number 274, the purchasing power of the money. What happens over the next 5 years if the purchasing power of the money goes down? Listen to this. cases have been decided. While in theory, changes in the purchasing power of money would have no possible effect on an award in eminent domain if it were always possible to determine and pay the amount due when the taking occurred or shortly thereafter. But in practice, this ideal is unobtainable, since the federal constitution and the constitutions of most states bar the taking of private property for public use unless just compensation is paid to the owner. There is room for argument in particular cases that the ascertainment of what amounts to just compensation requires consideration of changes in the purchasing power of the money. Footnote number 9. St. Louis versus International Harvester Company. Boys and girls, over the next 5 years, the purchasing power, the CPI, things are going to change. And Mrs. Kello, who might be entitled to $1 million today, 5 years from now, that purchasing power might have gone down to $200,000, which means that they've got to pay her $5 million 5 years from now. Has anybody ever thought about looking at the literature to find out about our rights before we actually go to litigation? Now, I mentioned at the beginning of tonight's program, the final in the series, Judge Clark reamed me a new one because I didn't do my legal research. Now, I haven't exhaustively researched the Kello case, but I think in this series of programs I've showed you enough here that Kello's getting screwed. She's got her eye off the ball. Her legal counsel didn't argue the right issues. And what she's being robbed of isn't even on the table. Nobody's talking about the real value of the property, which is the view and the location, not the nails, not the rocks, not the mineral, not the earth, not the glass, not the boards. That's not the value. That's only worth $200,000. Market value is all that's worth. The real value is in the rezoning. It's the commercial. The real value is in the view. The real value is in the location. Now, I don't know. Maybe they did consider that. Maybe they've already had a jury trial. I don't know. I can't make those kind of judgments or calls, but I can say this from my personal experience, that in the cases of eminent domain, there is no shortage of information on eminent domain. There are thousands of cases that come very close to Mrs. Kello's case, and issues that need to be raised both at the jury trial, at the negotiations, and at the appellate level, in getting what the Constitution guarantees us, and that's just compensation. You can't stop the freeway from coming through. I cannot stop Highway 160 from taking a section of my farm and putting the highway through my farm. I'm not even going to argue about that, but boy, am I going to argue just compensation. Boy, am I going to argue long and hard about how much are you going to pay me for the loss of my farm. When I got to move my cattle, how am I going to get them across the road? Are you going to build me a conduit under the road? Are you going to build me an easement? Are you going to give me ingress and egress? You know, what am I going to get out of this deal? And the government's going to offer me as little as possible, and I'm going to demand as much as possible, and somewhere in between we're going to reach an agreement. And that's why we teach law here at the law school, is to show you lay people how to get what's coming to you. And if you hire a lawyer, you probably aren't going to get what's coming to you. And I don't think Mrs. Kello is going to get what's coming to her. Well, we're about out of time, boys and girls. We're going to have to leave it right there. We'll be back tomorrow night, same time, same station, with some new topic. I don't know what it is yet, but we'll figure out something. Now, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Please order yours. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date. All right, time's up. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.